This is the Leadership and Insurance Podcast, brought to you by FinPro Search Partners.
Insurance companies are businesses and they need to look for the long term and be sustainable.
We went from zero to one and now it's going from one to 100.
Insurance as a concept, as a kind of service, is brilliant. The execution is what we're looking at now.
I think the companies that are going to succeed are the ones that are going to understand and master the art of intent.
When we talk about innovation, we lean too heavily to think about technology and we don't think about creating a culture of innovation.
I think innovation is essentially continuous improvement of existing processes and platforms and product.
Right? It's got to be easy. It's got to be seamless.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Leadership and Insurance Emerging Tech Series podcast. I'm your host, Gavin Savage, and I'm very lucky to be joined by the co-founder and CTO, Brian Mosley from Sixfolds. Brian, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. I just asked you that and you're not being honest because you're not actually too well at the moment. Brian's kind of coming down with off the back of a little cold, so I really do appreciate you taking the time to do this today.
Yeah, of course. It's cold season in New York, so we're all dealing with it.
And before we kind of get into everything, I think it's a nice place to start. And probably quite fun for you as well. I'm always interested in the kind of journey going way back into how you got into tech, really. You know, what was the passion for it way back into the beginning? And I guess how you navigated through your career into co-founding an insurtech in Sixfold.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to remember the beginning. It's like lost in the mist of time, but I just turned 50, so I'm still grappling with that. I don't know, I loved video games when I was a kid, and that kind of set me on the course for computer science in school. I was a senior in college. What my fraternity brother started a tech startup. This was in 95. So it was, the leading edge of Web 1.0. And that's the first taste I got of being, the fourth or fifth employee at a very early social media company. And that led me to dropping out of school and moving to San Francisco to work in Web 1.0, dye my hair and put earrings in and sling HTML and Perl. And I just had a taste for startups, and I did a lot of them over the first couple decades of my career, some other kinds of experiences as well, but a lot of very early stage. One that kind of rocket shipped to an IPO, so I got to ride that ride fairly early in my career, and a lot of other ones that didn't go so well. Eventually got to the point where I wanted to co-found my own. So 2013, I and a couple other folks started a hyperlocal journalism company in San Francisco. Still no one's cracked that nut in terms of like the business model around local journalism. It's still in the toilet. And so clearly we weren't successful with that. But after 3 years of being a startup founder and CTO and a longtime engineer, I thought that, there's a set of skills I'd haven't acquired yet about how to work and be successful in a big organization. So I joined a friend of mine at American Express, moved out to New York, and spent 7 years there. I was the head of developer experience there for 5 years. And I looked after the quality of life for 10,000 software engineers around the globe, helping take friction out of their process and helping radiate the technology brand of American Express outside the company. I had our open source office, so I got to advocate for a big budget to sponsor open source developers and projects and give back to the community, given how much of their work, our own internal proprietary technology was based on. So it sort of brought me to the point where last fall, Alex Schmelken, the CEO of Sixfold, and somebody I'd known for almost two decades, came and pitched the idea of Sixfold to me. And after 7 years in a Fortune 100 company, I think I was ready to go do something new again, something zero to one. And kind of the coincidence of that with the ChatGPT and the sort of the popular rise of generative AI is what made me feel like it was a good time to jump. So we started the thing in March of last year and announced our seed funding in May and just been off to the races.
Yeah, it's quite a journey personally, and And I was going to ask that question, like why then decide to go to American Express? But I guess we can probably like to unpick that a bit later on in terms of what were those skill sets that you felt that you were lacking. But yeah, I mean, sixfold, I mean, what a hit in the insurtech space, you know, timing coupled with the stuff around Gen AI that's going on. It's, as you say, it's taken off and you guys have gained a lot of traction quickly. For those that might not know who Sixfold are, I reckon the vast majority will that listen to this podcast, but could you kindly run us through the mission and vision at Sixfold, please?
Yeah, I mean the vision we have, at least of this slice of the professional world, is that we're able to develop by we and all of our many peer companies out there are able to develop AI that allows humans to focus on the work that's uniquely human, and use quote unquote the robots to to supercharge our abilities. And we think in our vision, it's much less of a delegation of responsibility and more of a, to the co-pilot, to the person sitting in the next chair, the robot in the next chair, and it's much more of like a melding of abilities to amplify what the person is capable of. And so, the kind of the business mission we have is to use this concept to bring AI-powered decision-making tools to insurance underwriters and to give our customers insurmountable advantages over their competitors through their use of these AI-powered decision-making tools.
Excellent, thank you. And how's you know, appreciate you're a startup guy through and through, but 7 years at you know, FTSE 100 and American Express, and then going back to you know, founding a company, raising funds, hustling again in the start. How's the journey been personally for you coming back into it? Was it like riding a bike, you know, or has it been a bit of an adjustment for you?
Both, I
Yeah.
mean, I like I said, I did 20 years in one company after another, lots of different, serving lots of different industries, and so the mechanics of starting from scratch and building something from nothing, beginning with a vision and just like slapping tech on paper and iterating furiously and testing with customers and getting feedback, like all of that's old hat to me. But there's definitely a lack of structure that you experience when you leave a big environment like that, and come back, and there's a tendency to want to import that structure from the bigger organization and behave like a more mature company too early. And so, I relied on external feedback to help me sense when I was falling into that trap. And sometimes knowing what it looks like when you evolve 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 generations is good to set you on a course, but you have to know that you're only taking the first few steps toward the mountain. You're not climbing the entire mountain right at the beginning. So I think it's very helpful to have had that big company experience and see what the future could hold for a company that's just getting started. But you really got to scale back the ambition in terms of the hierarchy you create in your organization, or the specialization of roles, or the amount of process you put into place.
Yeah, I mean, there's something quite fascinating for me anyway, you know, looking at American Expresses and multi-billion dollar making companies, how they just for hundreds of years have just ticking along nicely, and you know, it's like a well-oiled machine. There is something, whilst I'm a startup guy and I work in a startup at FinPro and we help startups recruit talent, there is something quite mesmerizing about those companies that just work so efficiently for hundreds of years, isn't there? But yeah, I think the reason I asked probably the journey aspect for you, how's it been, is because you've kind of came back into the venture space when it was really struggling, you know, in terms of raising capital was super difficult, probably a bit more challenging than when you were raising funds pre-American Express.
I think the tailwind we had this time was being associated with generative AI. Now, like we're a vertical SaaS provider. We're not building AI infrastructure, so it's not the same thing. But there's just some froth in that space in general. And I think the excitement, maybe in the venture community, to start to fund ideas that are applying generative AI techniques and building on that infrastructure that's been so heavily invested in to solve vertical business problems. And I think so. I think that was that kind of that was part of the timing aspect of it as well. That appetite to really start investing in those kinds of ideas was there.
And you know, on the kind of Gen AI piece, I kind of have conversations daily from a recruitment perspective when we're speaking with people like yourself, for example, in recruitment, but also doing this podcast, and I do struggle like. When we talk about insurance, the use cases for Gen AI, for example, what it's capable of doing, it's operational efficiency and time and speed, and it's frothy, fluffy words for me. I sometimes just I'd love just to get a bit more insight, especially from someone like you, and you know, appreciate maybe you can't divulge it, but those specific use cases whereby what is it that Gen AI can do for the insurance industry now? And I guess question is probably twofold. Do you have any specific use cases where you're really seeing might not be the most exciting, but it's clearly tackling a specific problem? And you know, have you in the past year to 18 months, do you think you've struggled to I guess get the message across as to how Sixfold can benefit the insurance industry? Like, has there been any challenges or reticence to adopting the technology that you guys are building?
So let me start with the first part of your question around, you know, what can Gen AI do for insurance? And I'll constrain my answer by saying we are very narrowly focused on underwriting. That's all we do. We see tons of opportunity outside underwriting, but our path to winning is by being really focused on one thing and doing it very, very well, better than everyone else, right? In the context of underwriting, what I think the opportunity is to not just is to graduate past sort of the mechanical gathering of data. I kind of like to call it filling in the spreadsheet, right? The underwriter needs to have access to a ton of information, whether it's, you know, commercial, publicly available commercial information, or it's an individual's medical history or health information, what have you. And they have to read it all and absorb it all and understand it and extract the nuggets in there that represent significant risk factors. And then they have to compare that to their company's risk appetite and decide, is this a good risk for us or a bad risk? And that human reasoning, that application of human intellect, that's the thing that Gen AI addresses that the previous generations of ML and other techniques didn't come close to. Or when other companies in previous generations of these of ML tried, they had to narrowly constrain the world, and kind of create their own new processes and their own new ways of thinking, and then force their customers to adapt. And so I think the opportunity with Gen AI now, especially how we're harnessing it, is that we can adapt our tools and the superpowers that we provide to the underwriters, to our customers, and how they work, and how and what their definition of risk appetite is, and then we can take that reasoning action that the underwriter is doing, that's pulling all these facts together and assessing them in a context, and an LLM can help with that. It can supercharge that. It can make it fast, and it can make it as accurate as the best underwriter out there. Doesn't necessarily have to be perfect in a way that humans are never perfect, but it can be as good as the best underwriter. And so, you know, with Sixfold, with our product, our assertion is that we will, number one, make the operation of the underwriter more efficient because we aid that reasoning process and we compact it. But number two, you know, we create more capacity to underwrite more and to generate more gross written premium because we can focus people in on the right risks and to spend their time on and create the capacity for them to do more risks, to evaluate more submissions, to find the right things and do more of them. So we're helping with the top line and the bottom line, and I think you could take the concept of facilitating human reasoning and apply that in many more places than just underwriting insurance applications, both within the insurance lifecycle, but also underwriting in other contexts. I mean, underwriting loans comes to mind, right? It's that reasoning process where we're adding a new layer of value on top of everything that came before.
Yeah. And I appreciate my two questions were quite long, but the latter part of the question being challenges, I'll kind of bundle it into what you've said with the underwriter's role. But you know, when you're talking about the massive amounts of data that underwriters need to sit and read through and extract those nuggets, hallucinations, confusion with AI that I see in day to day, and okay, it's one tool, and I'm sure you guys are building upon something much more in depth. But taking a really loose example, when I use ChatGPT on a daily basis for the obvious type of day to day challenges or tasks that most people use it for, and yeah, it gets confused a lot of hallucinations. So, you know, do you feel like there's still that, again, those challenges from communicating that this can help and this can be reliable, it's secure? You know, do you feel that reticence to the element of hallucinations and the AI being unreliable and not extracting the correct data and ultimately meaning that the underwriter has to just basically do what you've said they don't have to do anymore, which is, I don't really trust the AI, so I'm just going to have to go and read it all anyway. Do you know, you feel like that stigma's kind of loosening up and people are on board with it? How do you stop those kind of hallucinations and make it super accurate?
Yeah, I mean, look, in terms of the stigma, I think at the end of the day, what people are really worried about, you know, when you look at a business level, it's complying with regulation and it's making sure that that consumers get the right benefit and have the right protections. Mm. And so I think if you, you know, to go at the trust angle a little bit, how much do you trust your underwriters, right? You don't trust them 100%. Maybe you trust them 70%, 90% to get it right. And so you put compensating practices in place. You have an audit function that goes back and looks at the product of underwriting and says, did they get it right? How often did they make the right decision? Are there, you know, dimensions of getting it wrong that we can extract and learn from and put a feedback loop in place? And, you know, LLMs, generative AI, is similar in that it's probabilistic. It's not going to produce the same answer every time you ask it the same question. It's not going to produce the same outcome necessarily every single time it summarizes a piece of prose, right? It's not going to always find a fact embedded in a 100-page document the same way every time. And so that's why you have to keep the human in the loop and have the underwriter say, you know, look at the output of what came from not just the LLM, but like the overall risk analysis engine and say, that was right. That got it right. Oh, here's a place where it missed the mark by a tiny bit. Let's give some feedback to the model so the model can get better. Oh, wow. Here's a place where you completely got it wrong. The product is missing the mark here. There's some work to do iterating on the product to make it better so that the human makes the decision, not the computer. The human takes, you know, the output of the analysis process and uses that as an input into the pricing process, not the computer. And then the human gives feedback to the system, and whether that's feedback that pipes directly to the model to make it fractionally better, or whether that's feedback that goes to our product team to make the product significantly better in some meaningful way. And, you know, and with all that in mind, and knowing that the underwriter isn't perfect any more than the LLM is, then we have to demonstrate that we have the right guardrails in place, that we're protecting the health, the personal health information, the sensitive data that comes to the underwriter, and being, caring for it in the way that respects respects the consumers. When people understand that, and they look at how we're kind of like leading the way to help define the regulations and what good governance looks like in this space, then they build the trust. Right. Or they transfer the trust they have for their humans over to our system as well, because it's got the right checks and balances. They have their checks and balances inside the organization. Like we're even, you know, we're even being used in audit functions with some of our customers, where our tool is the thing that's checking to see if the underwriters got it right or not. So there's different ways that we can help with those feedback loops that they've already got. Right. And I think ultimately that's the best that can be done, like with this generation. Now, when we hit AGI at some unknown point in the future, then maybe there's a different level of trust or distrust that comes into play then. But right now, I think it's releasing this idea that the software's got to get it perfect every time in some deterministic, calculator-based, you know, 1 + 1 = 2 way, and comparing it to the human accuracy. That frames the problem differently for the customers.
Well, yeah, that's really interesting, and I appreciate that you guys are focused on, as you say, underwriting. I assume the main kind of customers are large carriers and MGUs then? Yeah.
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 That's right.
And do you kind of, the wider question, you know, the opportunities you mentioned, you and the team are seeing a lot of, you know, exciting use cases outside of underwriting. Do you kind of envision, is there any kind of specific opportunities that you're seeing with an AI that can have on insurance, like that you guys at Sixfold think, once we really nail this underwriting piece, we're definitely going to move into this area, you know, whether it be claims or, you know, whatever. Is there anything you're particularly excited about with AI outside of underwriting?
I'm going to give you an unsatisfying answer. We're excited about a lot of things outside of underwriting, about the possibilities for expansion, but we're really focused on conquering underwriting right now.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Fair enough. Brian, you kind of mentioned at the beginning of the show on, you felt like you had to go to American Express, and there was something that you were missing as an engineering leader or CTO. Like, what was the moving into American? What were those things that you were trying to, I guess, what were the strings that you were trying to add to your bow at that point? Because, as you say, you know, by that point you've got 14, 15 years as a leader. What did you feel like you were missing, and American Express could fill?
So, to answer your question, I have to correct you, because I didn't have 14 or 15 years of experience as a leader. Okay. I had nearly 20 years of experience as a hands-on engineer, focused on making the computer do things for me, but much less about how to understand human organizations, groups of humans, especially very stratified, very wide ones, globally dispersed ones, and applying influence and figuring out how to be successful in that context. Right. So I needed to grow beyond just my ability to make a computer put a fancy web page on screen. And and I couldn't think of a better place to do that than a highly regulated financial services company that had a global footprint, that had a very strong brand, and, as I discovered through the interview process, had a real focus on modern technology and doing things to my standards that I didn't expect when I first went there, you know, and started exploring. Mm. And so I was able to kind of take, I wasn't so constrained by the maybe lack of technology maturity that I couldn't be happy, but also had a ton to learn there about how to get groups of people to work together to accomplish common outcomes, or even how to work in the absence of shared goals with someone else who I needed. And, you know, with a function like developer experience where I spent so long, that's a central function where other people in the company are my customer, but also other people in the company are my dependencies. And I can't get anything done unless, say, the cloud infrastructure team is on board, or the enterprise architecture team is on board, or whatever. And so really figuring out how to step into other people's shoes, understand what motivates them and what success looks like for them, and creating win-win scenarios, like all of those kinds of skills. I didn't even know some of them existed or were necessary to be a good senior leader until I threw myself into that environment. And I think that's been really helpful. And then transitioning back into a startup, where I'm working so closely at such a frenetic pace with such rapidity of change, that we're constantly having to realign and retrack and understand what our shared goal is and keep working toward that thing. And those skills that I developed in that big company situation scale down really well.
Yeah, interesting. And you talked about, you know, the one of the big pieces, it seems, there is the, as you say, bringing teams closer together and figuring out how to work as a cohesive unit. Like, do you think now that, you know, what do you think are the most effective ways in doing that? Because we kind of spoke way back last year, and you guys were so busy, but I think that what you're big on is, of course, building engineering teams and product. You know, what do you feel like is the, what's your kind of mantra when it comes to, as a CTO now, as an engineering leader, when it comes to building teams and building teams that can truly work together side by side and not in silos where you have kind of engineering chucking stuff over to product? And, you know, what's your kind of mantra now following the stint at American Express?
I mean, it starts with shared goals. I had so many experiences at Amex where everyone was well-meaning. Everybody wanted their teams and the company to be successful, but everybody had a different notion of what success looked like. And so it wound up being, you know, an endless merry-go-round of me getting in someone else's backlog and quote unquote waiting for them to prioritize the thing that I needed. And where I had the most success is where I was able, either through my influence, to see that somebody else's goal would be advanced in some way by them helping advance mine, or where I was able to get somebody higher in the leadership chain where maybe I and someone else intersected to push down a shared goal so that we both knew something as prosaic as my bonus depends on us winning together, right? And those are different ways to solve this kind of problem. So when I you know, bring that kind of that thought process into the startup environment, it's very important that everybody on, you know, I have engineering and product and design, and it's very important that everybody across all of those functions and all of their specialties within those functions are keeping in mind what the big picture is and what it takes for the company to win, in terms of, you know, revenue goals or CSAT or whatever it is. And then what it takes for the technology to be successful at driving those business goals, and then within, you know, what we're trying to solve in the technology or the product space, what it takes for my user story to contribute to that that business success, and like having everybody have that same picture and constantly be reinforcing it, and having those connections created and you know, mentioned over and over and over again, like that is the transference of the idea of how to win in the big org down to the small org. And it's easy to do when everybody's sitting next to each other, or there's only 20 people in the company and we're all talking to each other all day, every day. We have small rituals that are easy to manage. It gets much, much harder, obviously, as you scale.
Yeah, not really, really great insight there. And that probably leads me on to the next question, which not next question, but element that I wanted to cover, the CTPO role is one that I think, just off the back of you saying that, do you think that, you know, there's a reason why we're seeing that evolution of CTPO or CPTO, whatever you want to call it, but the you know, the amalgamation of the chief technology officer and the chief product officer, like, it's been quite a trend over the last couple of years. Do you think it's because we're now seeing much more collaboration, true collaboration between engineering and product? And do you think it works as a role, as a title?
So I'll be honest with you. I'm new to this concept. I'm new to this term, CTPO. I understand it conceptually. Look, I'm going to be a little bit of a cynic about this and say, I think, number one, it's probably a way for people to manage their budget by collapsing two sets of responsibilities into one, especially, I can have, you know, one fewer co-founder, right? Or I can hire one few executive when I'm early on and money is so precious. I fundamentally believe in having a tension between product and engineering, having them have shared goals, but having them focus, like the natural focus they have on different elements of what it takes to accomplish the shared goal, forces hard conversations. It forces people to make trade-offs. It forces people to get out of their own kind of myopic worldviews. It's really healthy. That said, it's a little bit combining ultimate responsibility for both functions together it is a way to enforce those shared goals, like I described a moment ago, where you have an intersection of the reporting line that says this is what's important to all of you, and you're all going to work together as a Lencioni style first team to accomplish these goals. So it makes that easier. But also, I think a success factor for the CTPO role is that you love all of your children equally, and you put people in place who can execute each of those functions in the context you're providing for them, with the glue that you're providing for them, and that you don't prefer one or the other. Or like someone with my background, it would be natural for me to just live in the tech all day and to ignore the product viewpoint. And I can't do that. I've hired a great head of product to live in that world and do that job all day, every day. And in many ways, she's a partner to me, or she keeps me honest on things. But it's not passive. It's not a one-way relationship. I have opinions on how we use technology to create an amazing product, how we use design to create a product that people love. Because let's be honest, most enterprise software is either neutral in terms of user delight, or it feels like you're getting punched in the face. That's an aggressive way to say it, I know, but it's actively unpleasant to use. And I'm not gonna call anybody out by name here, but I think we all have those experiences more than we like. We want Sixfold, on the other hand, to be fun. And our design reflects that. And we want people to take pleasure in working with their AI superpower tool set, all day while they're doing their job. So without kind of balanced focus on product design and tech, it's way too easy for politics and competition to get out of hand, and the failure mode of the CTPO is that they can tip the balance unfairly in one way. And so I spend a lot of my time trying to make sure that we're keeping that balance, and then having great people working on my leadership team and who are empowered and have autonomy in how they do their work. And I keep them balanced. I keep them focused on the shared goals.
Yeah. I was going to ask, what do you think the most kind of common frictional points between engineering or product design and engineering are? But I think, as you say, there maybe isn't a trend of common friction points, but as you say, it's about bringing them back to the shared goals whenever there is that point of friction.
You know what I've seen? I've seen people that have trauma from previous experiences, and I've seen it commonly on the technical side, where the engineer thinks of the business or product or whatever as other. They're an adversary. They're someone, at best we live with them, at worst we're fighting with them every day. And it makes me so sad when I see that. And it's like that scared cat that you have to coax out from under the bed. And I think that's something you have to look for in the hiring process, to be totally honest. You want to find people who lack that trauma, who instead are compromisers, who have that empathy and can step in the shoes of the product person and see what it is that they're trying to accomplish or why they have the perspective they have, and find common terms and middle ground. And that's just a non-negotiable leadership quality.
I think it's tough though. I mean, like, you know, and I think even everyone has their previous bad experiences, and you're right, trauma is the perfect way of describing it, because you don't know it's trauma until it happens. So when you're interviewing someone, you're never probably going to get to the bottom of that trauma, but it just happens one day, and it can trigger people, and as you say, they'll go into the kind of defensive position of what they're used to. But yeah, that's a really interesting way of putting it.
So the complementary skill to have then is, or trait to have, is resilience. Okay, I've had trauma in the past, but I recognize it as such. And I can learn from it, and I can build coping skills, and I can learn how to put myself into positions where it won't be like that, right? And so finding those matching kind of characteristics of somebody, it's not sufficient to be a good leader in an organization, but I think that those are unnecessary traits that have to coexist with one another when you've been through those kinds of negative situations, the ability to move past them and be better than them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great piece of advice. And I'm running out of time here, but as the kind of CTO of one of the darlings of the insurtech world at the moment, everyone is loving what you're doing. What are you excited about the most going into the year? What's you've been through the really 0 to 1 stage, probably still there to a degree, but what's exciting you the most as a CTO for the rest of the year?
I mean, right now, there's a couple of things that come to mind. Number one, it's for our organization to develop the ability to walk and chew bubble gum at the same time, right? We have these major insurance customer segments, and we think our path to success is being able to serve multiple segments quickly. And because of that, we have to be able to shape our product. It needs to be able to manifest differently, say for P&C than it does for life and disability. We need to be able to support both. We're going to lose if we focus on one at the expense of the other. So having an organization that can deliver consistently meaningful go-to-market moments over time on both of those lines is going to be really important. And of course, there's expansion from there as well down the road. And then secondarily, I think there's building real robustness, resiliency, availability, performance at the AI layer, right? With the vector stores and the LLMs, and reducing the kind of risk of catastrophic failure due to over-reliance on one model provider or another, due to the ever-changing nature of models and the generational advances in models and their different latency profiles and the drift in their kind of ability to be accurate for us. So like really developing software infrastructure and like AI development lifecycle nuances that help get us to the point where we can confidently offer an LLM-based service with the uptime and the performance and the predictability and the trust, the predictability in terms of operational characteristics and the trust in terms of the thing always being there and always being able to work on my behalf that you would expect out of any enterprise-grade software solution. Just because LLMs are not deterministic doesn't mean we shouldn't have the same operational expectations for them. So we're putting a lot of effort into there. And I predict that we're going to be able to help advance the state of that. The technology infrastructure that enables those kinds of things. And I hope that we'll be able to do it in open source in a way that gives back to the community because it is so important to me.
Awesome. And then sprinkle on top of that, adding hopefully some more great people to help you do that, you know?
100%. Yep. Hiring, recruiting great people to build out the team and add more capabilities. It's the most time-consuming and important part of my job right now.
Yeah, I empathize with you on that front. Engineers are tough to hire at the moment. For any great engineers listening, get your CV in front of Brian at Sixfold. But I think that this has been a really great conversation. I really appreciate you again coming on. I know you're super busy and off the back of not feeling too well. As I say, we call it the lurgy in Scotland. But yeah, wishing you a kind of speedy recovery. But Brian, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Gavin. Thanks for having me.